The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 21st of September, 2018. On the podcast today, I have Lawrence Reed, Executive Director of Europa Metals, EUZ is the ticker there. And Lawrence discusses the upgrade in their JORC resource at their zinc lead silver project in Spain. Also on the podcast, I have Brian Larkin, Chief Executive Officer of United Oil and Gas, and Brian explains why they raised £3 million this week and also gives a progress update. Plus, I also have Andrew Knott, Chief Executive Officer of Savannah Petroleum, SAVP, and Andrew provides an update on the Seven Energy transaction and on operations at the Seven assets in Southeast Nigeria. Plus, John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talking about Bluebird Merchant Ventures, Blue Rock Diamonds, Anglo-Asian Mining. Also, Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about Strix Group, Parity, and Gear for Music. I also have Chris Bailey covering bigger cap stocks, Tesco, ITV, British American Tobacco, and talking about the imminent IPO of Aston Martin. Plus, I have lists of the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets and the top five most liked RNSs too.
Want to get live push notification alerts whenever a company you follow releases an RNS? Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Lawrence Reed, Executive Director of Europa Metals. EUZ is the ticker there. Lawrence, thanks for joing me.
Thank you, Justin. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Yes, and a surprising bit of news out. In fact, we had two bits of surprise news out because I know the biggie sort of coming is a scoping study before October, but you've released an updated JORC mineral resource estimate for the Toral project, so we'll get into that in a bit. Before we do, as always, Lawrence, I've noticed a lot more activity, actually, on social media about Europa Metals, so I'm assuming there are new investors around. So for people, you know, new to the story or just new to the podcast, can you explain or summarise what is Europa Metals all about, please?
Certainly. Well, it's a European-focused resources company, and we like lead, zinc, silver. Lead, zinc, silver's, on average, had a fantastic run over the last 12 months. But don't invest in us because of that. That's not the point of this project. We want to build long-term sustainable mines. And what we have at Toral, which is our key project, is a really nice project where we have taken masses of historic data, which wasn't really looked at, wasn't really understood. So a huge historic core shed containing over 41,000 metres of diamond drilling. Which we sort of discovered down in Andalusia, some many hundred kilometres away from our project, which is in Castilla-León, in Ponferrada. And essentially what you see today is you see a resource updating for our first resource in January, where we've sent teams in and an independent resource estimator to, or consultant, sorry, a bit tired, been a long morning, and to go through everything and relog and relook and understand. And we've announced this fantastic resource today. And more than that, we understand much, much more about the project, and we're really excited about that. So it's great having this announcement out today. We're very happy about that.
Yeah,
but we're also extremely happy about everything we've learned as well, which we're going to keep quietly in the background for us for the time being.
Yeah, well, it's worth mentioning the figures, and it's also worth mentioning, like you say, these. In fact, I can't let slip there. You said this is a lead, in a project, and they were building mines. And you talk plural then. I did pick up on that, so I'm listening. So maybe if you want to expand on that a bit later, but never know. But let's go into the figures here on the JORC mineral resource estimate, and this is worth pointing out. This is from historical core logs, isn't it? So this is not from data from any drills, and you are drilling at the moment, aren't you?
That's right. We're doing extension RC drilling at the moment, and that's really way down in the east, just to see if we can pick up the mineralization as it extends. And it's also the first time, if you like, the new team has been drilling, so it's bringing a new drill rig to site with a new team together. And we're just drilling. We're moving from hole to hole at the moment. And then very, very shortly we'll be moving, if in fact we haven't already, moving back towards the main resource area to begin drilling around there. So that's not into the main resource as yet, although that is going to come, but it's much closer to the main resource to pick up the lead zinc contact. So we've got all of that. So we could do that as a drilling program. But we have this huge amount of core. If you go to our website, if you look at the pictures, you'll see this amazing core shed. And this was drilled, again, have a look on our website, by a number of companies, including Lundin. So we've got this huge amount of money that's been spent on Taral. And I'll be honest, we're looking through everything and we're finding so much just by going through this massive amount of data. So really, what Europa is in a sense built on the shoulders of giants. But we think we've got the technical expertise and understanding to look at these projects or look at projects like Taral with a new understanding with modern techniques and to wring the value out of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're a 19% increase in zinc equivalent in fed resource to 19 million tons, and of course, 7% increase in contained zinc, 6% increase in lead, and 8% increase in contained silver. And that's impressive, isn't it? And
it's really impressive. I have to say, just I'm conservative sometimes, but that is a serious increase. I mean, that's that, especially from the type of work that we've just done. We're very proud of this work. The Spanish team should be very proud of this work. You know, this is the type of increase which, you know, usually comes from drilling and drilling and drilling and drilling.
Yeah, exactly. And so what's next? I mean, we know the scoping study is next, isn't it?
That's right. The scoping study is still scheduled to come out by the end of this month. So we're running around like crazy doing that, working with AMS on that. And then what I think we're going to do is we'll probably make a bit of an announcement in the coming weeks, if you like, the next stage of the work. But really what we're doing is we're getting into, let's start looking at get some indicated resource. And that's going to be really exciting. Mm-hmm. Because that's where a lot more value can be wrung from, and a lot more understanding about the mine plan. The scoping study is just the first step. Mm-hmm. In a sense, what we'll be doing is probably geotech, met holes, infill into the high grade areas, and start building this project up. But you know, this project is now we are thinking about this as a development project. Mm-hmm. Or moving towards developments, let's put it that way. Yes, that's where we are. Very happy with
and
that.
Just to explain to people who don't know about that, I mean, you know, when you say you're moving to infill, essentially what you're looking to do there is prove up the confidence of what you've got there, isn't it?
That's completely right. So there's different measure categories of resource. So we operate, we're an ASX-listed company as well as a name-listed company. Mm-hmm. So we are subject to all the strictures of the Australian Stock Exchange and also ASIC, who are their regulators. So we operate under the JORC code. So what we want to do is we want to increase the resource category and the understanding. Mm-hmm. Of the resource. At the moment, it's all inferred. It's a great resource, very happy with it. But we want to move it up the categories. It's not just about tons and tons and tons, Justin. Tons are always exciting, absolutely. More tons of grade are always exciting. But it's, can it be economic? And we think we've probably, we'll find out. But we think there's enough here to actually work with. Yeah, we do want more. Yes, it is open in various areas. So what would be the point of sort of continuously drilling out from all angles right at this moment, spending lots of shareholders' money, where we can actually concentrate on the main area, if you like, and say, look, this is a mine. This is a project, and look at the economics.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're probably not going to tell me, but when you do say this is, we're here are building mines, this is our lead project, what did you mean by that?
Oh, well, just in terms of, sorry, you've slightly thrown me there. Just, I don't think there was any loaded background to it.
Okay.
But I just mean that...
I just wonder how far ahead you're thinking there. After this, how far ahead down the line you're thinking? Because I know this is the lead project there, and pretty much I know you've got another sort of prospect there in Spain, but you haven't really done anything with that, I don't think. But are you thinking further down the line? You're looking at other projects maybe as well?
We're always happy to look at things. Obviously, through our shareholders' support, we've had a bit of success on the share price, which is fantastic. And we're very mindful not to interfere with that. So we do look at things. If we were to do something, it would have to be the right thing. But really, at the moment, right as we stand, we're really excited by Terral and building value out from that. Now, on your point about how far away ahead are we thinking, well, yeah, we can't go mad and lose our heads and think, oh, it's all going to be done. There's a tremendous amount of work to be done. There's an awful lot of stakeholder engagement to be done. But in a sense, you've got to look forward if you actually believe in your project. If you actually believe your project can be something that adds value by bringing metal out of the ground rather than all the other exciting metrics people can think about, you've got to have a real plan. You've got to put it in place. And that's why we started the planning approval process, change of land process with municipalities, is we think this is real. We want to push it towards a production outcome. You know, that's what's exciting for us. Yeah. I think Terral's hugely exciting. I think as we go on, as we get more indicated, etc., you know, we'll keep releasing updates. We'll release updates on our economics. I think it's going to be a really exciting year. I mean, to be honest, the more I look at everything we're doing, I think actually this is just the beginning, to be honest. Yeah. I think the next 12 months are going to be absolutely fascinating. And it's always risky business, exploration, and say that to all your shareholders is absolutely true. There'll be some ups and downs, but from everything that we can see, we've had a great 6 months, but it's the next year, which I think is going to be fascinating, especially things like metallurgical geotech holes, getting right into those high-grade pink zones with the drill rigs. You know, can't wait to do that at the right time. Sorry, I'll shut up now.
No, that's good. And you know, you mentioned stakeholders there. I mean, I assume you're always in contact with people about this, talking about the project, are you? You know?
We have a very careful structure with all of those elements, which I'll leave a very capable team and consultants on the ground to deal with at this time. But domicile within Castilla and Leon is amazingly important to us. The support we've received from the Junta and the DG is extremely important to us. So we're just going to be mindful about how they direct us, continue taking their advice, and just slowly and quietly but thoroughly progress our way through all the necessary permitting, listening to people as we do it.
Marvellous stuff. Well, one final thing, Lawrence, for people listening right now but are not following the story as yet, but I've seen this released in the updated JORC resource and they're quite excited by it. Give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
I think if you look at our resources compared to other peers out there, ours stands up very well. It's extremely competitive. I think you're entering a phase where over the next 12 months, you're going to see more and more knowledge coming out about how you can mine towards and into the high grade zones. You know, look at the pink bits on the block model. That's the interesting thing. But also looking at the sort of the halo around it. It's not really a halo, but around it.
Yeah.
Of lower, but still very attractive grade editing. And I think actually, and I have this argument with people, I think transparency of supply chain and metals across all metals is going to be becoming increasingly important. And I'm a genuinely believer in that. And I
what do you mean by that? Is it transparency mean what? Being in Europe is advantageous to you?
Yes, exactly that. You know, if you are a US electronics company making stuff that comes from the DRC, that is a problem. That is an acknowledged problem. If you're making batteries, that's a problem. Now, at the moment, it's been certain, you know, battery-based technologies, some of them. But I think over time, what you're going to see is more and more a look at where does this metal come from. So yes, the EU and Spain has a high burden of regulation and licensing, but actually, you know, I hope I don't regret saying this, but actually let's embrace that. Let's actually say this is a good thing. We're going through all these permissions and then we can demonstrate it to our offtake customers when the time comes.
Yeah, yeah, more stuff. Excellent. I don't know if you did your 3 points there, but I'm sure that's good enough. Anyway, a lot of good chat to you, and like I say, you are progressing this, and no doubt the scoping study will be out very soon, like you said, before October. Is that still the case?
Yes, it is. Sorry, I was having a sip of tea, not pausing rather rudely there. Yes.
Dramatic pause there. Yes, it is.
You took me by surprise. No, we were all sitting around on Monday at the Institute of Metallurgists, which is by Euston, going through everything. And as it stands today, we are on course to do that because we asked them the question repeatedly. Yeah, so there we go. That's where we are. And we sorry, Justin.
That's all right. Well, listen, we'll be chatting again very soon. No problem at all. So until then, have a good one and speak soon, Lawrence.
Fantastic. Thanks, Justin. Take care.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Brian Larkin, CEO of United Oil and Gas. UOG is the ticker there. Brian, thanks for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome. Good morning, Justin.
And there's been no sort of operational update, but demand from shareholders, come on the podcast. So it's nice you've come on, Brian, because I know, you know, people like to be kept abreast. And I suppose the last thing you did was a major thing, was the placing to raise money, and we'll go into that in a bit. Before we do, Brian, you know, you've got a lot going on. You're still pretty much new on the stock market, and there may be people out there not familiar with the company and what you're doing. So give us a brief summary. United Oil and Gas, what are you all about, please?
Yeah, well, we're a former Tullow Oil team, Justin, as you know. We started the company in April 2015 last year we listed the company with one license in the UK and an option agreement on a license in Italy. Since we listed the company, we've added 7 more licenses into the portfolio. We've drilled a successful well in Italy and found gas. We've appointed an industry heavyweight as chairman in Graham Martin. Graham was on Tullow Oil's board for 2 decades and led their entire M&A program. And most importantly, on top of all that, we've doubled the share price. So we've had a busy year since we listed. Our strategy, essentially, well, our key objective is to create as much value as we can in our share price. And how we do that is via our strategy. And essentially, our strategy is, it's kind of dual approached. It's a low risk development, near term producing business in Europe, coupled with a high impact blue sky exploration business outside of Europe. And where I'd like to get to over the next year or so with a company is a producing business in Europe, essentially funding an exploration business outside of Europe. And what that would mean for shareholders is every 12 to 18 months, we should have a roll of the dice on a exploration target, not too similar from our Jamaica license. Mm-hmm. So that's essentially a high level intro to the company.
Yeah, and I like that dual strategy because, like you say, you know, the high impact exploration can really transform a company. You see companies' share prices go nuts on just the spudding of a well. But like you say, it's a roll of a dice because the odds are often stacked against. But you can underpin that valuation with lower risk, cash generative sort of projects. And I know you've done so many deals since you've been on, and I think you have 9 sort of interests here, but you recently raised money, $3 million, and for a while you said you're always looking about, you're always looking for deals. So this $3 million pound raise, was it done with an immediate deal in mind?
Well, yeah, we've got a couple of things in the hopper at the moment, but just on with the portfolio for a minute, just one key point about our existing assets. And, you know, we bear this in mind when looking at new opportunities. We have a very balanced portfolio between risk and reward. And what that essentially gives us is there's no company breakers within the portfolio, but there's lots of potential company makers. Mm-hmm. So if one opportunity, for whatever reason, wasn't to come in, the business wouldn't fall over. So when we're looking at new opportunities, you know, that's one of the key kind of deliverables for us, is that wherever we look at, that if we bring it into the portfolio, it's only a potentially company maker. But yeah, we did raise money recently. We had an investor evening in London about 6 or 8 weeks ago. We were expecting about 35 people to it. We got close to 100, which was a fantastic result for us. But in the audience that night was a couple of potential new shareholders who recently approached us. They were looking to build a position in the company, but they thought it would take them a while to get to the level that they were at. So they approached us with a potential placing, and we opened it up to a couple of existing shareholders, and ultimately we got a book of £3 million done very quickly at no discount to the share price. In fact, it was actually at a premium when the placing was agreed. And with some warrants on top. So it's a fantastic deal for our shareholders, we feel, and it puts us in a very strong position when looking at new opportunities, in that it'll give us, we can pull the trigger very quickly if we wanted to on something without having to race out to the market to try and raise money for a deal.
Yeah, that's nice. The two guys, they obviously quite, what, individual private investors, or were they part of a company?
It's a group of individual private investors, yeah.
Okay, so they saw the presentation, obviously been researching like you, and say, okay, we want to get take a stake in this guy. And that's good, isn't it? Because, you know, you'd assume they're long-term investors.
Oh, without question, the long-term investors, they're in for the long haul. They believe in the company, they believe in the management team, and they believe in the assets, most importantly, and the fact that, you know, they have commented to me that they believe the price will re-rate over the next 6 to 8 months, and I totally agree with that. I think with the high-impact news flow we have from the existing portfolio, let alone any other deal flow, I think the existing portfolio alone should generate a re-rate in price over the next number of weeks and months, as we drill Coulter, as we move Jamaica forward, as we move our Italian projects forward, as we move our UK portfolio forward, we should see significant news flow.
Yeah, and you say you've been looking at deals, and are there a range of, you know, risk and reward ratios? Or obviously you can't say too much from here. Are you looking at high impact, or, you know, near-term cash generative things, or a mix of?
It is a mixture, but I mean, I have gone on record and said that we'd only raise money if we were looking at whoppers of opportunities, and we've two or three in the hopper that are well advanced. We are in the final stages of our technical evaluations. There's obviously some commercial discussions still to close out, but I'm very pleased with the progress we've made in that front, and it's given me confidence to take money now at this price to put us in a position that if we wanted to close one of these fairly quickly, we are well resourced to go and do that.
Yeah, because, I mean, I know there's a perception that amongst private investors sometimes that raising money is not hard. But, I mean, then a company comes out and raises money at a massive discount, and, you know, private investors shout and scream. But it's never an easy environment to raise money, is it really?
No, well, it's always tricky. You know, you have to have a compelling story. You have to have a carrot and a stick post deal so that people can see the way forward in terms of the share price, and people will feel that they'll make a quick, you know, be a quick bang for their book. Post completion of placing. So no, it's not always easy to raise money. It's difficult, and there's a lot of challenging companies competing for the same pool of cash. So you have to have a very compelling story, and this opportunity came along and it made sense. It seemed to be good value for our shareholders, and as I said, it strengthens our hand, and that if we want to go and close something very quickly, we can pull the trigger really fast, and that's a nice position to be in. Yeah. And if you're looking at opportunities, you know, you're walking in the door of bigger companies and you're looking at opportunities that they may have, or, you know, you're trying to carve out something from another company. Having, you know, them knowing that you're fully funded and can move quick is very attractive to them. So it does strengthen your hand.
Yeah, yeah. Today there's news announced by Andlas Energy, sort of farmed into Coulter. So that's good. What do you make of that?
Well, it's further validation of the asset. You know, another partner coming in is always a good story. It's further validation of the asset. I mean, we obviously believe in it, and as I said to you on a previous podcast, I think this is the first summer of my entire life that I've been wishing away the summer to get into the autumn and winter period to drill Coulter. We believe it's potentially a game-changing asset for us. It's a 50-50, which in this industry is fantastic odds. We're highly confident it's going to find hydrocarbons. It's just a question of whether or not those hydrocarbons are commercial enough, and we certainly believe that it's worth chasing it. We like the story there, and it fits perfectly within our strategy, and we welcome Andlas into the joint venture.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when do you think this happened now? Six to 8 weeks, is it, or what?
Yeah, approximately. I mean, you know, I've been in this industry long enough to know that there's, you know, there's variably slippage. We've had some slippage already. Hopefully that's it and we can just get on and drill it. But, you know, we're coming into the winter period. You know, weather can slow things down and things like that. But, you know, hopefully hopefully we're still on track for 6 to 8 weeks' time. And, you know, it'll be a short enough drill period. So, you know, we're hoping just to get on with it now. That's the main thing. We just get on with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's that, you know, commercially, what's it worth to you?
Well, you know, I wouldn't want to put a number on it at this stage. What we'd like to see is the result first, and then we can start thinking about some internal valuations as to what we can put on it. Until you drill, until you start drilling these things, there's only one way to de-risk, and there's only one way to find oil and create value, and that is by drilling these things.
Yeah.
And as my chief operating officer said to me last week, the best place to find oil is where there's already been finds of oil. And that's exactly what we're doing with Calter. It's a fantastic target. It's a low risk, as I've said. It's essentially an appraisal stroke development project. And, you know, it's great to have analysts on board. And, you know, we look forward to moving the joint venture forward over the next couple of weeks. I mean, we're already sourcing long leads and things like that. So hopefully everything will fall into place now shortly.
Marvellous stuff. Well, Brian, thanks for coming on for that quick chat. And before you go, if people are listening right now, likes the sound of this, but are not yet following the story, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to the watch list, please.
Yeah, well, as I said before, I could give you a rake of reasons. But essentially, we have a lot of high impact news flow over the next number of months between Calter, Italy, you know, the Italian project's moving forward nicely, development plans with the ministry. Start planning some 3D seismic now for perhaps Q1 next year. Top of that, we've got Water Cross. We hope to move that forward into drilling Q1 next year as well. So that's the first thing, I guess. The second thing is the team is very strong. Our technical team is absolutely excellent, and I think if you look at what we've delivered technically over the last 12 months in the portfolio, you know, there's not many companies have added as much licenses into the hopper as we have, and moves technical stories along so quickly. So the team is very strong. And I think the third thing really is that we've, you know, that if you look at the track record, anytime we've raised money, we've always gone out and done something significant afterwards, and we've just completed, you know, a placing at essentially a minor premium to share price, plus some warrants on top. So, you know, I'd say the future for United over the next 6 to 12 months is going to be we're going to go through a really exciting period.
Excellent stuff, Brian. Good to chat to you, and like I say, lots going on. So hopefully we'll be catching up again in the not too distant future.
Thanks, Justin. Take care.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Andrew Knott, CEO of Savanna Petroleum. SAVP is the ticker there. Andrew, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
And I got some news out, some progress there, and you've done an operational update. So it's about the Seven Energy transaction. Before we get into that, Andrew, as always, there are people brand new to the podcast, people not familiar with the company. So Savanna Petroleum, what's it all about, please?
Okay, so we're a UK-listed oil and gas company. We have interest in two countries. We have a business in Niger, where we've enjoyed a lot of success this year, both on the exploration and on the monetization front. And then we have interest in two large oil and gas fields in Nigeria and an infrastructure business in Nigeria. So that's about
it. Marvellous stuff. And today you give a sort of a seven energy transaction and operational update. So take us into it, Andrew. What is happening?
Okay, well, today's news is really very significant for the company. What we've done is we've announced that our proposed partners in Nigeria, we're effectively buying out. So versus the original acquisition, that increases the reserves and resources that we are acquiring by about 19%. We add another 25.1 million barrel of oil equivalent of 2P reserves and over 2,000 barrels a day of oil equivalent of incremental production. But what the deal also does is it reduces the capital expenditure that we'll have on the assets going forward. It materially increases the level of control that we have over the overall gas business in Southeast Nigeria, which means firstly that we're in a very strong position to determine the growth and to grow at the rate we want to grow at, which is obviously at a significant pace. And also for us to further control costs, and we expect to be able to deliver some quite significant cost savings as a result of the transactions that we're announcing today. Also, the other thing that we're announcing is that we are advancing with the extension of the pipeline network that we have an interest in Nigeria. What that does is that will add 20 million scf a day of capacity, which is about 80 megawatts in terms of the power that's capable of providing. But more importantly, that gives us a target on a gross basis of about $50 million of incremental revenue to come through from that pipeline extension over the course of the coming years, half of which would be the benefit of the midstream business and half of which would be the benefit of Savannah's core upstream business. So the announcements today are pretty significant, and I think as well from a market perspective, one of the frustrations the company's had over the last 2 or 3 months is that we've not been able to explain what we're doing with the transaction in Nigeria, because obviously it constitutes material non-public information, so you can't talk openly. But what should be very clear to people today is that the reason why we've been delaying completing the transaction is a good reason. It's because we're trying to acquire more and get the control, and also we view the transactions as fundamentally value accretive. But now that we've done that, that enables us to progress forward to close out the other aspects which required resolution to this issue. Because, for example, for the creditors, it impacts the security packages. For the government approvals, then you have to get the full transaction approved, etc., etc. So I think it's good because of what it does for the business, it's good for what it does in terms of our cash flow profile going forward, and it's good from a market perspective, because what today's announcement lets us do is to talk freely and openly about how the transaction's proceeding.
Yeah, so this is kind of a big deal. I mean, and was this always the kind of sort of plan in the background there, Andrew?
For a long time, these are transactions that we've been working on for a long time. And I think we've been saying that the opportunity to get assets that you know, like, and understand, if you can get more of them, then that's a good thing. But fundamentally, the increased control it gives us over our business makes these transactions somewhat of a no-brainer.
Yeah. And as far as, operationally, what's happening at the moment? Where are you?
Okay, so from an operational perspective, the Nigerian business is now, all its customers are taking gas, etc., although near-term production levels are not meaningful from a cash flow perspective for the Nigerian business, just because it's covered by take-or-pay obligations. So that's less so. In terms of the Niger business, which you mentioned in the opening, so the Niger business, we have 500,000 petroleum basin under license in Niger. We've drilled 4 wells, we've had 4 discoveries. We're in the process of drilling our 5th well, Zomo, which is a potentially very significant well for us. It's just to the south of the largest discovery we've made to date, Andy. So I would expect that we'll have that well result over the course of the coming weeks, probably over the course of the next fortnight. And clearly we're hopeful for what that will bring. I think separately, in terms of what's coming up, is we'll be providing an update in terms of the progress we're making on the early production system, and how the economics look for that early production system, which is clearly quite important, because that will bring in another cash flow stream. And I think something which has happened over the course the last 6 to 9 months is that really there's been 2 incremental cash flow streams that the business has developed. So one is the Calabar Gas Distribution Network, the project that I talked about at the beginning, and then the second is this early production system that we've got in Niger, neither of which at the time when we announced the original Seven Energy deal were things which people were talking about, and neither of which, to be fair today, are in the analyst numbers in terms of their cash flow forecast for the business. So I think we've done well year to date in terms of developing these additional cash flow streams, and certainly our focus going forward will be to continue to try and develop additional cash flow streams for the business. So from a Niger perspective, that will be incremental sales waste to sell incremental oil in the early production system, followed by the export solution, and then in Nigeria we'll be opening up other sources of gas sales.
Yeah, it's amazing how much the business has evolved over the last 2-3 years, isn't it?
Yeah, look, we've gone from a business which had a very exciting early stage asset in Niger to an asset which is now in the process of maturing, plus the addition of the business in Nigeria. I mean, but both businesses are material. I mean, we expect the Niger business to make a material tax contribution to Niger once we start the early production system up and running. And the Nigerian business supplies 10% of Nigeria's available power generation capacity. So they're both significant businesses in their own right, but we think are capable of delivering a lot of value for all our stakeholders, financial and otherwise.
Yeah, marvelous stuff. Well, Andrew, one final thing. If someone's listening to this now, that's the sound of what you're doing, the progress you're making, and the way the company's evolving, but are not following the story, given those 3 quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Okay. So, I mean, look, I think fundamentally we've got 2 very high-quality assets. The asset in Niger, from an exploration perspective, we believe to be truly world-class. The assets in Nigeria, the base upstream assets, are very large, half a trillion cubic feet gross gas fields. And then we've got high-quality infrastructure associated with that. So fundamentally, we have good underlying assets. And then the second reason would be around both assets are set to deliver quite significant cash flow growth. And there's additional optionality around other sources of cash flow growth, which we're seeking to try and add to that. And then the third one is from a capital growth perspective, specifically in Niger. We have a business model where the finding cost is about $1 a barrel. The NPV per barrel for the early production system we expect to be around $6 a barrel, and we view that as relatively repeatable success. So there's the potential for quite significant capital growth as well. So I think we've got good assets that offer a good combination of both cash flow and capital growth.
Marvellous stuff. Andrew, good to chat to you and good to get the update, and no doubt we'll be chatting again in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Yeah, as ever, thank you for having us. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. You're right, John.
Yes, very good. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Right, so let's start off with, I know we wanted to look at a macro theme here. And I did look, I did actually tweet out some of the metal prices yesterday, and they were looking quite buoyant. And in fact, I didn't note that zinc was at the top there, but copper was up there as well. Why were metal prices doing quite well when, essentially, a lot of my stocks that are in these areas at the moment, last couple of days, have not been doing very well? What's happening?
Well, copper was leading the way, and this is very largely on the back of greater demand from Chinese infrastructure, and that is somewhat greater than expected, and it's lifting the whole metals complex. It's also being driven by stronger iron ore prices, stronger steel rebar prices. So there's a lot going on in China that is driving metals demand, and it was good for markets to see that, and markets which have been in a bit of a negative or not quite sure frame of mind turned around fairly convincingly and said time to buy these prices back up again.
Yeah, okay. And so what was the figures out there? Figures were showing that what trade is going well. What was it?
Well, there are figures. I'm not quite sure what the exact numbers are, okay. But worth mentioning that there are rumours this morning,
yeah,
that the Chinese are going to put zero tariffs or lower tariffs on a lot of non-US imports. So, what this looks to us is it's a signal that the Chinese are going to become a fairer and freer economy to deal with, that they are opening the doors, and they said, okay, we're going to do this on non-US products, so that will stand out against the US to some degree. And I think probably the next move is to sit down with Donald Trump and agree a sensible deal where actually we end up with a zero tariff situation between China and the US, and everything kind of gets equalized. And it's been a long time coming, but we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. I was like, well, what I quite liked is that Trump said he's going to put increase tariffs on $200 billion worth of goods, so he upped the ante a little bit. And then he also said, if you come back with any more, I'll do even more. But they did come back with some more, and they've even upped their ante a bit by saying, well, we're now taking tariffs off all non-US goods, which is very clever. But yeah, it is coming to a head, isn't it, this thing? It's only going one way for the global economy. That's bad. It's bad for the global economy, so they'll have to sort it out. You know, it's not good for anyone, really. No one's a winner in these kind of trade wars, are they, really?
Well, it creates a bit of uncertainty, and nobody likes uncertainty. But I think if we look at Trump's negotiating style, he goes in very hard. He roughs up the opposition, and then they sit down and they agree something a bit more friendly.
Yeah. So do we know the timetable? I mean, you're obviously a good friend of President Xi and Trump. You're in their phone book, John. Can you give them a call and say what's happening? Let's get together, have a chat about it, get it sorted. None of us are liking it, you know, get it sorted. So is it going to happen before these midterms, you think, November?
Well, I can't say I can pick up the phone to Donald Trump, but I can pick up the phone to people who know him. And none of us quite know exactly how he's going to react, but we're fairly sure that this is the end game that we're heading towards. So we'll see where we go.
I assume you're joking when you say you can pick up the phone to people who know him. You're joking there, are you?
No, not at all. No, if you look at some of the directors of companies that we follow closely, you'll see that one or two of those are diehard Republicans.
All right. Very interesting, John. Oh, I should add to the start of this intro, I should say, John Mayer, mining analyst and partner, and generally well-connected chap. That's quite impressive there. Right, let's go and get on to some sort of stocks then, John. Any news out on some stocks of late?
Well, we had a little bit of news out from Bluebird Merchant Ventures. They have reported that they've completed the feasibility study on their Gubeng gold mine in South Korea. They aim to bring that into gold production for about 100,000 ounces a year, which is good. It's going to take them a while to do that, but the fact is at least they've got the feasibility study done. It was another important point in the sort of chain of events to earn their 50% of the project. So that's a nice bit of good news. But we're a bit short on the detail there, so we're still waiting to see the numbers that come out of that feasibility study.
Yeah, absolutely. BMV is the ticker there. What else, John, are you looking at? What other companies?
It was Blue Rock Mining. They've got a diamond mine in South Africa in the Kimberley region. They're mining a second diamond pipe now, and they've got some very good grades coming out of the new lower levels in that diamond pipe. It's an open cast mine, so it's pretty low cost to run. They did report losses for the first half, but I think that will turn around in the second half, and I'm looking forward to a turnaround situation, lower costs, higher revenues, and a much, much better second half to come.
Okay, but it's BRD, Blue Rock Diamonds, there's the ticker there. And anything else, John?
Well, last but certainly not least, Anglo Asian Mining, very good quality stock. It's a client of ours, of course. And we've raised our valuation on that to 84 pence a share. I think at some point we'll be over a pound on this. We're still waiting to see more from the resources side of things, as in how long will these mines continue for. The company has proven itself to be good at finding more resources as it's gone forward. So we're expecting a new resource statement out from them sometime soon. And very importantly, the company's announced that it's going to produce a dividend of 3 cents a share. If you look at the directors of the company, you'll see that they are big stakeholders themselves. So that not only are they paying the market, but they're also paying cash back out to themselves, which is something they've been looking forward to for a long time. And I think that the business is generally running very well. So they say they're going to produce, they're going to pay out 25% of net profits going forwards. And that's very positive for investors in the longer term.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Always good to see when you're invested in a company from the start or early on to the point where they're, you know, an explorer, then go to producer, and then they start paying a dividend. That's a nice little journey to be on, isn't it, you know?
It sure is. And these guys have been very dedicated to the business. If you look at the composition of the board, they are a good quality team. They've been there a long time, and they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. Thanks for that, John, and we'll speak next week.
Good. You're very welcome. Okay, see you then.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
I'm very well, Justin. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
And, good, you sound chirpy.
Yeah, I'm all right. Well, do you know what? It was not last night. Wow, that storm.
Wild, huh?
Yeah, about 1 o'clock in the morning. Oh. What the heck is going on out there? But it's quite nice today. It was nice, clear up.
No, it's good. It's calming. I was expecting my trains to be cancelled this morning up from Brighton to London and all sorts, but no, all ran smoothly. Yeah. I've been to see my fishmonger in Borough Market, just near our offices in SE1 in London, and he was on a boat last night, 70 mile an hour winds. I don't think that would have been much fun.
Yeah, you don't want that, do you?
They are brave guys, I tell you.
Yeah.
And girls, perhaps, but certainly brave. I don't know how many girls are on his boat, but they're all very brave, whoever
absolutely.
It is.
Well, do you know what? Oddly, to tie it in, I mean, the weather's a bit like the Brexit negotiations at the moment, isn't it? It was a bit stormy, it was a bit stormy last night. And
tempest
then
tossed, I think Theresa May looked in the newspapers this morning.
Yeah, I mean, that speech she made after, you know, after basically they give the cold shoulder, I don't think she's convincing anyone there, apart from herself even, that you know, it's still ongoing, still all good, a lot of work to do. well, you haven't much time left, to be honest.
I must admit, my conviction has always been that there'd be a last-minute deal in, you know, March 28 at 23:55 or whatever, but I must admit, my conviction in that is wavering, and I suppose the Europeans just feel they have to take a hard line, because if the British go with a deal, then the Italians and some other devils will be turning up with their hands out. So I suspect, you know, that's probably why they feel that they've got to take a very hard line, otherwise there'll be, you know, further candidates perhaps looking to slip out the back door.
The thing is, though, Russ, is like, you know, a deal has to be sort of done in some way, or it's do or die, because like I say, you know, when you're negotiating to buy a house, you can walk away, there's plenty of other houses there, but there's not plenty of other sort of, you know, massive blocks of economic powers we're dealing with as far as UK is concerned, and we have to sort of deal with them or not, so it's looking a bit worrying, isn't it?
It is. I must admit, my view has always been that there'd be a sort of Greek-style compromise right at the end, late March, 5 minutes to midnight kind of thing, because that's the way they sort of got their way through the debt crisis. But I admit that my confidence is wavering slightly at the moment. I guess the Europeans feel they need to take a tough, you could argue, intransigent stance, because if they give way to the British, the Italians might queue up with their hands out, or somebody else might look for a way out the back door, or even, dare I say, the front door.
Yeah.
So in that respect, they certainly feel that they cannot be seen to be giving any ground at all. The British, clearly Theresa May is politically boxed in at home. She can't be seen to be giving up too much. And equally, you know, I guess it's, you know, Donald Trump's art of the deal. You go in, you take a really tough stance, be as hard as you can, and see what, you know, compromises you can extract. And I guess the tricky bit is, you know, in theory, although we're working to end March, I guess really we're working to sort of mid to late November, because then any deal that's reached has got to go through the British Parliament and past the 27 EU members. So it is getting tighter. I mean, to my slightly pleasant surprise today, you haven't seen the gilt market sort of firm up a little bit, and you haven't seen sterling go down. So, you know, people aren't perhaps getting too worried yet, but it's clearly still, you know, exercising an awful lot of people.
Yeah. And part of me always thinks we do worry a lot more. In reality, things often don't turn out as bad as the worry we, you know.
Well, this is the argument that Tim Martin of Witherspoons would take, for example. You know, he says, you know, there may well be some short-term disruption, but he would consistently argue there'll be long-term benefits. Roger Bootle at Capital Economics do the same, and he's no dummy. And there are lots of people out there who will argue that, yeah, in the end, the world's going to keep spinning. Things will be different. But so we'll see what happens, and we'll see who's right. At the moment, it does look like we're inching closer to a no deal. The Europeans even seem to be now getting to the point whereby they're prepared to sacrifice the £39 billion that the UK in theory owes the EU under its existing financial obligations.
Yeah.
That is how hard a line they clearly feel they have to take at the moment.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's get on some stocks. I know you've got some highfalutin meetings coming up. So
I have. Yeah, I've got to get my skates on. So a couple of fund managers. But yeah, so the three stocks, all ones we looked at before with varying degrees of success: Strix, Parity, and the Gear 4 Music.
Okay, Strix, go on. What's happening with Strix?
Strix, lovely ticker, KETL, AIM, Kettle. This is the Kettle Controls and Safety Devices Company. Floated in August 17, and it's been a successful float, which coming out of private equity isn't something that you always necessarily expect. We first looked at it in May at 140p, and it's ticked up to the late 150s, so all well and good so far. And there's been sort of two positive pieces of news subsequent to our first look at this back in the late spring. Besides now sort of being, you know, 38% global market share in kettle controls and safety devices, they've now just done a collaboration with the US coffee machine maker, which may open up a whole new vista for them. And then the interims came out this week. They were solid, I think is fair to say. Revenues up 2%. Pre-tax profits actually down 2%, a little bit on some investment and some higher finance costs, although debt came down. First half dividend as promised, 2.3p, looking to get the full year up to about 7 pence this year and 7.7 next year. New product launches, they've settled an intellectual patent dispute with a Chinese rival who's, I think, has capitulated. That shows how strong that Kettle's IP is. And so overall, a solid, decent set of numbers. You got a stock on 11 times earnings, 4.3% yield with operating margins, high 20s, very cash generative, and a very strong intellectual property backing to it. It looks a good, solid business. It's not going to knock you off your feet for growth, but it looks like it's well positioned, and you know it's going to be a touch wood, a steady dividend payer, if nothing else.
Well, it's had quite a steep rise, isn't it? This half year. So, I mean, you know, I always worry after a big steep rise like that, you know, you're bound to get a bit of a sell off. So,
yeah,
let it
I think there'll be a bit of consolidation. Yeah, exactly.
Marvellous. What's next for us?
Parity, PTY. We first looked at this one of the first podcasts we did in spring 17 together at just under 10p. It rocketed all the way up to 15.5p on the turnaround story that I think we spotted. The company had been on a failed acquisition spree. New management came in, began to move the business away from low margin recruitment to higher margin consulting, and the story was very simple. Margins and profits up, debt down. So obviously positive momentum in the P&L and lower risk because the debt coming down. And we've had the first half numbers this week, which were in line, showing the story. Sales up 2, operating profit up 12, pre-tax profit up 25. So that gearing effect of costs down, margin up, interest and interest bill down. But the kicker was Chairman John Connolly, short-term client-side delay at one big contract, classic small-cap territory, unfortunately, dependence on a select number of clients or contracts. The rest of the business quote in line, and if we get seasonally normal patterns, and if there are no more delays, we're going to be in line for the full year. Debt went up a little bit as well. So the story's changed a little bit. And I think given all those ifs, buts, ands and maybes, unfortunately, we've lost a lot of the gain that we had. It's come from 15.5p back to 12. Mm-hmm. My inclination is, I think we've had our fun. The investment case has changed. It's still in transition. And I think, as we know with small caps, once things start going a bit all right with one big contract, they can go a bit all right for a bit longer. So I think safety first, take your profit, and then come back and have a look in the spring, probably.
Yeah. Okay, marvellous stuff. And what's the
last one? Gear for Music. York-based, my hometown, no less. Yeah. Remember, it sells musical instruments online. The brands that you know about. It's big in the UK. It's expanding distribution centres in Germany and Sweden. It's been a tremendous momentum story. We first looked at it at £6.10 in May 17. It got to £8.50. It's now just gone back below £6.10. So I'm like, crikey, I must have missed something here. And to be fair, that the trading statement on the 7th of September, I mean, there's, you know, UK sales up 34, European sales up 39. All well and good. Mm-hmm. But they did say that things were going a bit slower than planned in Sweden. They were upgrading a UK facility, which is fine. They're forecasting a better second half, but they do talk about competitive pressure on gross margin. They've even talked about moving their year end from the end of February to the end of March, which is okay, but could be done for a reason and not just cosmetics. And so it's one of the problem that you've got is it's on 55 times this year's earnings, 34 times next year's, and you've not got any earnings upgrades now. Yeah. So, you know, once you have a momentum stock that's losing earnings momentum, you've got a problem. So I'm going to cut and run.
Yeah. And so when you mentioned there, when companies sometimes move their year ending dates, what is the possible reasons they do that?
The reason that they gave, which I understand, is that it reflects seasonal patterns in the business, which I'll explain in a minute, and also it clashes with some big trade fairs, I think. So from management's perspective, they probably think they're trying to do too many things at once. So I get, but if you think about it, in the old days before house builders nearly got a horrid fright 10 years ago and nearly went bust, they all used to report net cash balance sheets, even though they used to report an average interest bill every year. Mm-hmm. Go figure. Why? Because in the end, you know, just think of when do people all buy their, you know, when's your busiest year for selling houses? It's probably springtime, right?
Yeah.
So they all tend to have their year ends in April, May, June to make sure they get the maximum amount of cash in. So they've got the maximum amount of cash in then, but over the rest of the year, they're obviously building their houses and it's working capital out. So it's the optimal time for them to report their balance sheets because all the customer cash has come in. Although in the old days, when they had net debt, they still reported an interest payment to the banks, even though they were saying at the end of the year they had net cash. Now they're all net cash anyway. It's not such a big deal. So for Gear for Music, I would bet Christmas, let's face it, is going to be an absolutely massive time of the year for them. And they're probably still collecting all the readies in January, February. So they might think that by the time they get to the end of March, they've got all the beans in, and the counters will be happy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, marvellous. It makes sense. Yeah, excellent stuff. Russ, thanks for that. And,
it's a pleasure, my friend. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, speak next week. Speak next week, fella.
Be lucky.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Hello, Justin. Yeah, good, thank you, good, thank you.
I've got to say FinancialOrbit.com. I got the orb stuck in my mouth for a second there. Couldn't get it out, don't know why, but there we are.
There you go. Well, I always use Orbit because, of course, it's the whole world, and that's what you got to look at when you're an investor. You might only buy UK stocks, but they exist in a big global economy. So when I was trying to think of a name, Orbit kind of came to mind, really.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's look at some stocks. I mean, I just asked you there. I mean, at the moment, last couple of days, I've noticed, and it's often a trickle-down effect, like small to micro-caps, pretty much. And they can be rallying when bigger cap stocks are having a bit of a bearish time. But at the moment, my stocks in my portfolio particularly are having a struggle. Last couple of days, I think. I don't know what it is, but what is the bigger cap space like at the moment?
Yeah, it's okay. I think it's a bit all over the place, to be honest, because you've got some big themes out there, you know, the inevitable Brexit, where the pound is and stuff like that. But the reality is, if you look at UK stocks at a global level, and I guess, you know, international investors, they always will look at the biggest caps first and then kind of trickle down, as you say, over time. UK stocks look pretty cheap. And that's because there's a bit of skepticism about the whole Brexit debate and what the economy is doing. But also the fact that some of the big sectors in the UK have been sort of underperforming. Certainly some of the more domestic centred stuff has been very poor, retail, banks, utilities, etc. While some of the international stuff, it's got buoyed by the weak pound over various points of the last couple of years. But the pound's obviously been starting to edge back a bit. And so people are wondering what to do. So it's a bit all over the place, the UK market. But for my mind, I think there's loads of opportunity.
Yeah, I think if we get a breaking deal, of course, which I'm sure should happen, you know, because, you know, it helps both, you know, not just us, but the European economies. Then I think we should see a nice little relief rally, especially if off the back of that we get Trump and China sorting out their issues. But we could see a heck of a rally. But anyway, let's look at some stocks, and I think we're looking at is more of a domestic market this week.
That's right. And look, you've got a couple of interesting announcements in recent days from, and it's been heralded first by the press. You know, the way these companies work, big companies, that they often put something in the press first, and then it's announced, and then it's discussed, and the market takes their view. Take Jack's, this new sort of store concept by Tesco's. You know, the weekend press last weekend was full of comment about it. And finally, the Tesco's have come out and actually talked about the concept and are just on the cusp of launching the stores. I think as we speak, the stores are being launched in a couple of locations nationwide. You know, Jack's, named after Jack Cohen, the founder of Tesco's 100-odd years ago, it's basically trying to look the Aldis and the Lidls square in the face, whilst, of course, the core Tesco brand is a bit more whole of market. They've got some lower value stuff, lower price point stuff, but obviously they've got some of their finest ranges and other things too. So interesting idea from Tesco's. I was a bit sceptical, to be honest, because I thought, hang on, this is just going to cannibalise sales. They're not probably going to make the margins. You know, what's the point? They're just driving themselves down market when actually they could compete against the Germans at so many other levels, convenience, delivery, range, that type of stuff. But actually looking at it and listening to what they said, I think this is going to be a very focused rollout. They're going to try and learn something from it, and it's not going to be on every neighbourhood in the country. I think initially it's going to be in a couple of locations. They'll probably have 10 or 15 stores in a year or two. It's basically where they've got a big Tesco store. We know that the biggest Tesco's, those massive, great big stores, which they built sort of 10 or 15 years ago, which are just not really working that well. It's where they've got one of those big stores. It's not really working as a Tesco. So they're going to chop it in half, sell half of it to some other retailers, whoever they may be, and use the other half for Jack's to try and make a different, slightly more price-conscious appeal to local customers and shoppers. I think give it a go, see what happens, and go from there. But I think the core Tesco's business shouldn't be too impacted by all of that.
Yeah. One thing to understand, like Lidl and Aldi, that is their business. They are discount, that's it. that's it. Now, you know, with Tesco, they've announced this bit, and I saw Dave Lewis on the news last night, and someone said to him, so is this going to be cheaper than Lidl? He said, cheapest in town. I said, cheaper than Aldi? Cheapest in town. Cheaper than Tesco's? Is it cheapest in town? And so it's odd, isn't it? It's a bit of cannibalism here, really, you know?
Precisely. It is really tactical. And, you know, I think that, as I say, it's probably where the big Tesco's has failed. And to my mind, what I would do if I was them, I would stick a medium-sized Tesco's in, which is just probably much more amenable and focused on what the local consumers want. But there you go. They've decided to go with this Jack's concept. I'm not wholly convinced. But the good thing is, if you're a Tesco shareholder, and I still think this is a sector you've got to be long of, because again, we've got Asda Sainsbury's chunking along in the background, and all that does is that just takes capacity out of the market, and that's a good thing for all of these food retail companies. And so for me, that the sort of the Tesco's and the Morrison's turnaround stories, they've still got a little bit to go. There's not as much to go as a year or two ago, but there's still something there. They're chucking out dividends to a greater degree. It's a necessity business by definition. I would still be for choice long of Morrison's and Tesco's, thinking there's a little bit of value, decent dividends in some cases, and I think you'll do all right, certainly versus alternatives like cash in the bank.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. Okay, what else are you looking at, Chris?
Well, the other one, which was sort of all over the weekend press last weekend, was ITV. And lots of chat that they were going to buy or looking to bid for this Endemol. Endemol's this content business, studios business, famous for things like Big Brother, if I'm sure lots of people have watched that over the years. And Endemol is in the process of trying to sell itself, effectively. And ITV have been named as one of the bidders. Now, that's fine. Studios and content have been huge growth areas for them and many other media companies. It's a big industry focus and a good thing for ITV to be in. However, my gut feel when I read the reports last weekend was that this deal is just way too big for ITV. It would be about over half the size of their current business. I don't think they'd be able to fund it organically. They'd have to do a money raising or something like that. And it'd be a big and bold bet on content. But you probably, because there's other people interested, you'd pay a pretty penny for it. And I just think it's just a bit too big, and they can spend their money in wiser, slightly lower profile, organic sort of content ways, sort of continue building up their ITV Studios business piece by piece. So they had a big capital markets day in the middle of the week, and interesting, it was 100-odd slides, really interesting presentation about all sorts of stuff, digital, sort of the changing requirements of the consumer, content and studios, how that's becoming more important, all really good and interesting stuff with all the razzmatazz you'd expect of a media company, all things which sounded great. But then when they were asked about, so are you going to bid for Endemol? Are you going to bid for assets like that? It was a sort of a, you know, we'll unveil our strategy on that in due course. It was just a bit frustrating, to be honest. If I was them, I'd love for them to have said, look, guys, we're disciplined, and, you know, this is just a bit too big for us. We're going to do it much more organically. That's what I much prefer to see. I think when companies go on empire building, massive deals, 50-50 on whether it works or not, probably even worse odds than that. Mm-hmm. So I was a little bit disappointed ITV didn't clarify on that. Everything else sounded great. And you look at the ITV stock and the shares, it's got a big old dividend yield now. It chucks out cash. It's got an interesting position. They seem to know what they're doing around digital and studios. I think they should just avoid the big deal. I think that's overhanging the shares, which are just north of 150 as we speak. I think actually more realistic value for ITV is much nearer £2 a share. But I'm afraid until they clarify on this big deal, maybe you get no real movement on that until that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've dipped down. And it's funny, I saw someone on Twitter, obviously new to investing, says, what's going on? Why is the share price down? That's a good deal if they're going to do a deal. If they're going to, I don't think they understand that buying a company costs a lot of money. You know, it does cost money.
The trouble is with all acquisitions is that egos get in the way and empire building. And of course, sometimes deals are great, right? And we can all point to companies and occasions where a deal has been fantastic. The trouble is, most of them, I reckon well more than 50%, just don't ultimately really wash their face. It's more about empire building by managers, the ego of saying, look, we're expanding the business. It sounds great. But of course, it's what you pay and what sort of cash flows and profits you can get from it that matter much more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. What's next, Chris?
So quick one on BAT, British American Tobacco. Obviously a popular stock among investors. Big old yield, like or loathe tobacco. We know it's an area where there is pricing power and a sticky customer base, say rightly or wrongly. But the tobacco stocks have been really on the wane this year. I think BATS is down 30-odd%.
Yeah.
Imperial Brands is not dissimilar. It's been a rough old year so far for tobacco stocks.
Do they get most, all of it pretty much? I mean, their revenue, does it still come from cigarettes? Or are they yeah. diversifying or what?
I think that the hope is that they are trying to diversify. And obviously we've seen lots of these new next-gen products, e-cigs, vaping,
yeah.
and burnable technologies and other stuff which you can barely think about, which are coming in. But at the moment, whilst they're growing their customer bases in those areas, it's nowhere near as profitable as cigarettes. But clearly they've got to be there because they can see the market changing. So cigarettes are the cash cow, but all these other areas they need to be in order to satisfy the consumers of tomorrow. Basically, that's the way they're thinking. I guess what's upset the market is that you've had some new competitors in vaping and e-cigarettes, which have taken a bit of market share outside of the sort of the usual tobacco brands. And that certainly caused people to think twice about tobacco shares. My personal view would be that this sector is offering a bit of value here. I say like it or loathe it from a moral perspective. From a purely financial one, I would say risk reward is all right here. The interesting announcement on BATS today is that they've announced that their CEO, who's been at the company for over 30 years, he's been CEO for the last 8 years, is actually going to step down in a few months. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of comment saying, well, obviously that the formal press release is all, you know, fantastic job, what a servant, loyal servant to the company, he's going to retire, wadi-wadi, et cetera. I think the reality is, though, is that they need some new ideas. And BATS is basically looking for somebody. They said it's probably going to be an internal candidate who's going to freshen up the offering, who's going to basically push back and try and reverse some of this 30% share price fall. So for me, watching out what's happening here is probably quite interesting. I think tobacco shares are a bit out of favour, particularly if you think that markets are a bit too excitable. When markets turn, when they focus a bit more on value and dividends, tobacco shares should be right up there in terms of the areas that the market turns to. So interesting announcements from BATS. For choice, I'd probably be a buyer of Imperial Brands, which I think has got all the same attributes, but is not quite as challenged in some areas as BATS is. But I think this whole space is interesting for value investors or for dividend hungry investors as well. And interesting that BATS are choosing to change their CEO at this point. I think that's probably a sensible move.
Yeah, I know in markets like ours, you know, definitely cigarettes, the sale of them are decimated. The amount of people who used to smoke, obviously years and years ago, compared with now, completely different. But they've got a big foothold in the emerging markets, haven't they?
Yeah, that's right. And it is increasingly emerging markets business. If you look at BATS or Imperial Brands, they're increasingly emerging markets. The thing is, Justin, it's not just the number of smokers, even in the developed world. Mm. It's, of course, the pricing power. And of course, what you're seeing is the number of sticks, as they call it, basically the number of cigarettes that they're selling or packets of cigarettes they're selling is going down. And that's going down sort of high single digit percentage a year. However, they're pushing up prices by a not dissimilar amount a year. And as you say, they're growing in the emerging markets. That's the basic business model. Yeah. And then you latch onto that sort of the next generation stuff, which they've obviously got all the distribution systems and the customer contacts to sort of make a benefit from. And they've all got, in different guises, vaping products or burnable products or e-cig products. But as I say, they've bumped into a few new competitors, which has just taken the edge off people's perceptions. But I say, I'm not a smoker myself, you know, but different people have different views. And certainly from a financial perspective, interesting space, I would say, at the moment. Gives you a bit of emerging market exposure, bit of dividend income, and a bit of sort of out of favour contrarian exposure, which is always good to have in your portfolio at some level.
Yeah, absolutely. But I just think, generally, I mean, obviously, it will take me years off, but surely these emerging markets will catch up and realise that, it's essentially bad for your health, and the trend will go down. You know, I'm just wondering how many years of dominance they have left there, you know, but who knows? But, probably plenty if you're saving for your pension, if you're in your 40s, I suppose, but there we are. Anything else, Chris?
Well, final piece has got to be Aston Martin. Now, I know, obviously, they're your favourite car company, Justin. I know you drive nothing else.
I own a couple of them.
That's right. The Corgi ones or the Matchbox ones? But it's interesting that they've obviously, they're coming to the market. The initial public offering is close, should occur in October. But they've announced the pricing range, if you like. Whenever a company comes to the market, they've got to say, obviously, what they're doing, how they're doing it, what their latest numbers are. But then when it gets closer to the actual float, they announce a pricing range, basically the range within which they're going to hope to list the shares. What strikes me about Aston Martin is that you could drive a luxury car through their range. It's between £4 and £5 billion, which, you know, is a huge difference, a billion quid difference. So basically, if people are pessimistic, they say, well, you know, we want to get it a bit cheaper because we're worried about the world or whatever, then maybe it comes closer to £4 billion value when it floats. If people are a bit more optimistic, £5 billion. That's a big old range. That's much bigger than normal. Generally, it's a bit tighter than that. So it's going to be an interesting one to watch over the next few weeks. I reckon if there's any shareholder perks going, that's got to be considered.
Yeah. It's, but you know what? It's a lovely looking car, isn't it? That Aston Martin's. And I think, you know, over the last few years, and they've really come ahead. And it's just, it is one of those aspirational models. And it's amazing how a billion in difference in the gap there between. How does that happen? Why is it so far out? I don't understand. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, basically, it's because you're trying to price hope. And with any luxury, it's a luxury good, let's face it. With any luxury company, you're pricing hope. Yes. And you're pricing where the company might be, how it may appeal to future consumers. Let's not forget, Aston Martin's gone bust or has had bankruptcy proceedings against it 7 times in its history. You know, autos is, to use a sort of a wonkish term, an operationally geared business. It's all over the place, basically, at different parts of the economic cycle. So, you know, investors got to factor that in. They've got to factor in the strength of the brand, where the luxury car demand is going, what peers like Ferrari are valued at. It's a complex old thing. And as a consequence, if you're a bit optimistic, you're saying $5 billion is the price. If you're a bit more realistic or pessimistic, maybe it's $4 billion. Or actually, if you're a real pessimist, you're probably saying this is bonkers and it should be way less than $4 billion. So as always, there's different views in the market. Mm-hmm. And obviously, fund managers and investors will decide what they think. And that's always important. You know, do what you think. So that's what everyone's going to be doing over the next few weeks. And they are hoping, I think, that the price pops somewhere in the middle in terms of the reality of what fund managers are prepared to pay for it in order to get shares, but also to make money on it prospectively as well.
Yeah, marvellous. Chris, thank you for that, fella. And we'll speak again next week.
Sounds a good plan. See you then.
Okay, it's time for the top 5 most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at 5, ECR Minerals, ticker there is ECR. At 4, Botswana Diamonds, BOD is ticker there. At 3, Strategic Minerals, SML is ticker there. At 2, Europa Metals, EUZ is ticker there. And number 1, of course, Predator Oil and Gas. I say of course because it's very highly followed. I mean, it's gone up 300% in the last month. It's dropped back about 30% this week. But, you know, on a rise like that, you would expect some consolidation. But it's still being highly followed. Number 2 is Europa Metals. And, of course, Lawrence is on the podcast today. Okay, it's time for the top 5 most liked RNSs today. At 5, Metal Tiger, notification of major holdings. I think that's Sprott, I think I read by that. I'm selling down a little bit, I think. At 4, AIM suspension, SDX, of course, rumours there, but them buying assets from BP. At 3, Andalas Energy and Power, farm in and issue of equity. Done at just a 2% discount, and they farmed into the Coulter, well, which I talked about with Brian on the podcast. At 2, Rehobold Resources, Andalas Farming, to Coulter. And at number 1, STX Energy. Recent press speculation. I just mentioned that. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.